So, hi everybody. Happy New Year. I was just looking at my talk that I wrote, and I titled it Not to Stealth. And I was really careful, so it was funny to me that I started with a big spelling error. Anyway, from the class on the first grave precept, and Jean talking about killing with words, that really provoked a lot of thought in me, and so I incorporated that in, what I'm going to say this afternoon. It's hard to think of a case where stealing can be done without harming. I don't think it's difficult to refrain from stealing someone's property. We might wish it were our own and suffer from the desire we feel. We might even feel less than because we don't have what this other person has. So we suffer from comparing ourselves. We could feel jealous, which could rob us of the connection we may have felt with this person. So you could say we're stealing from ourselves in this situation. When I get hijacked by these kind of thoughts, I lose my sense of contentment, knowing that I have everything that I need and that I am enough. An alternative to this kind of thinking is the practice of sympathetic joy, taking pleasure from another person's good fortune. Sylvia Boorstein points out that when we take pleasure in the good fortune of others, we get to be happy a lot more than if we only take pleasure when we get what we want. In Norman's book, Taking Our Places, he points out how generosity is another good alternative to stealing. He recommends that we give away as much material stuff as we can. And the same thing with our time, attention, and care. It is wonderful when you can let go of material things and money if and when you're able to do so. I am a pack rat. I still have clothes from when I was in college. I don't wear most of my clothes, so I've been filling bags and taking them to charities, but I could and should do much more. I can feel my clinging mind at work as I pull things from my closet. I pull out a shirt that I have not worn in years. I look at it and say to myself, "This is a really nice shirt. I'll keep it and make sure I wear it soon." Recently, my wife and I filled six grocery bags with clothes and delivered them to St. Anthony's thrift shop. It was nice stuff, not junk, and it was a liberating experience. Life felt a bit lighter. Several years ago, I was at one of Norman's workshops called Company Time, and one of his co-teachers was this wonderful Zen priest. I remember that she said that her house got flooded and most of her possessions were destroyed. She said that in spite of significant loss, she felt liberated from having less possessions. Up until that point, I never thought that losing possessions could be a good thing. I was unconscious to the way that possessions can possess you. You worry about losing it or damaging it, they take up space in your mind and heart, and often your house. Many years ago, I was at a retreat led by Thich Nhat Hanh. He told a story about a time when the Buddha was sitting with a group of monks in a field by the road, enjoying the sunshine and sharing lunch. A farmer came running up and he was quite distraught. He said his cows ran away, and he could not find them and was terribly upset. The Buddha told him that they had not seen his cows and pointed down the road and suggested they may have gone that way. As the farmer ran off, the Buddha turned to the monks and said, "You are very happy monks. You have no cows. When I have a possession like my house or car and find myself worrying about the expense for unexpected repairs, I refer to them as my cows." Other ways you can be generous. You can happily share your time and attention. Simone Weil, a French social and religious philosopher in the early 1900s, says that attention is the rarest and purest form of generosity. You can share your knowledge and talents with others that could use your help. Christopher and Alan from our Sangha, who are builders, have helped me out a lot with problems I've had with my house. You can be compassionate with someone who's experiencing hardship. You probably have felt like that and can offer validation of their feelings so they don't feel alone with them. Again, from Norman's book, Taking Our Places, he mentions other ways we may be stealing. If you use more of the world's resources than your fair share, you are stealing from the earth. If you buy and make money on a stock of a company that causes damage to the environment, you're supporting a company that is stealing from future generations. What about cheating on your taxes? I know that I'm conditioned to find any way to pay less taxes. Given that this is a cultural norm, is it limiting the amount of resources the government provides to those who are economically disadvantaged? I'm sure that we all have been guilty of stealing time. In the early years of my career, I would go to work very early in the morning and get home at 5 or 6, tired and drained. I did not have the energy to play with my kids, or chat with my wife, or check in with friends to see how they were doing. Our culture favors those who work hard, have successful careers, and make a lot of money. Not so much for spending less time at work and more time with loved ones. Another way we steal time is just wasting it. I can go down rabbit holes on my computer or iPad. I subscribe to a few periodicals and will see the title of an article that looks interesting, and the next thing I know, an hour or more has gone by. And I can't get it back. This means I have less time to help someone or take care of myself. I have a friend who seems to be filled with gratitude for all the goodness in her life. She has a hard job but rejoices in her accomplishments. She is an artist and gets great pleasure from her projects. And she sees the good in people and rarely has something negative to say about someone. Her partner is the opposite, she says. He is judgmental, untrusting, and a worrier. He sees the glass as half empty. She sees the glass as overflowing. Her exact words to me were, "He robs me of my joy." So when my friend said this to me, it made me wonder if I've unconsciously expressed doubt or warning of potential disappointment when it just wasn't necessary. Just because it comes to mind, I don't have to say it unless it's truly helpful. My wife has had breast cancer 3 times. She is cancer-free and healthy, I'm happy to say. Recently, her oncologist told her she has a 30% chance of a reoccurrence in another part of her body, maybe in her bones or brain. Neither of us asked her about future possibilities, but she shared this information with us anyway. There's nothing I can see that is useful from our knowing that, but now it is in the back of our minds and is an unfriendly reminder that the good health she enjoys may be temporary. By being pessimistic, sarcastic, and critical, we rob others of their hope and inspiration. If you are boastful, you can rob someone of their sense of being enough. When someone is speaking of someone they think highly of, being skeptical and judgmental can rob them of the happiness that comes from true human connection. When I feel manipulated, I feel a sense of loss. I thought this person liked and was interested in me, but they just wanted something from me. I think we can tell when someone is angling for something by saying nice things to us. I've been guilty of buying things I don't really need. Any of you who have been to my house know that I have enough Tonkas to open a shop. Sometimes this keeps me from making a donation to a worthy charity. So my carelessness turns out to be another kind of stealing. Buddhism teaches us to live simply, which I take to mean living with what we need and not overloaded with what we want, but don't really need. I think this is difficult living in a culture of consumerism. The growth in our economy is based on increased consumption of goods and services. There are 45,000 shopping malls in the US. Many years ago, I went on a 10-day monastic retreat with Ajahn Sumedho. He's a wonderful teacher, and the retreat was special. It was so popular that they had to hold a lottery to determine who would be able to attend, as they had more people who wanted to come than there was space for. A couple of years later, the same retreat was offered, and again they had to have a lottery to determine who would get to attend. Because the prior retreat was so wonderful, I decided to try my luck at getting in again. I did get selected and I did attend. In Buddhism, we're taught about cause and effect. If I do this, that happens. My greedy behavior in regard to Ajahn Sumedho's retreat meant that someone else missed the opportunity to sit a wonderful retreat. I was not paying attention to my self-centered thinking and behavior. A few years ago at our session, when we were at the first sitting at 6 a.m., it was dark and cool in the Zendo. There were 50 of us sitting together in complete silence. It was exquisite. I had this glorious feeling of pure contentment. I knew that I had everything in my life that I need, and I felt free from desire. So that's the good news. Later in the afternoon, when we were sitting, my body hurt and I felt sleepy. I wanted that early morning joy back. I was caught in the trap of wanting things to be different than they are. My wife is a very kind, generous, and undemanding person. I sometimes wonder if she gets as much from me as I get from her. I fear that it is unequal And preparing for this talk, I gave it a lot of thought. I'm going to try and do better. One of the ways I've stolen from myself is not doing or saying something because of fear. Fear of failure or saying something that I'll be judged poorly by, or just plain saying something stupid and not useful. When I was a kid, I was afraid to play any sports because I was sure I would be terrible at it. I was in a bookstore a few years ago and saw this book titled Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. So that's what I do now. I still feel fear, but I try not to let it stop me from doing something that I want to do. My experience sometimes when I'm sitting out of nowhere, I find myself thinking of something I did or said and occasionally recognize a mistake I have made. If I can do something about it, I do. If I can't, I promise myself I won't make that mistake again. This was the case with my going on the retreat a second time, not awake enough to realize I was taking something away from someone else. So, what makes us behave in ways that are stealing from someone or ourselves? Isolation, missing human connection. I think it comes from a feeling that there is scarcity, that I don't have what I need. And I have anxiety about it. Looking for something outside ourselves to make us happy, something external like a thing or an experience. Referring back to Norman's book, he talks about how he likes to patronize locally owned businesses, even when he's paying more than had he gone to one of the big box stores or Amazon. His practice is to see the money he gives them as a donation for their families and the merchandise that he receives as a gift. He has a similar practice in relation to jobs that he has had. He sees the work he is doing as volunteer work and the check he receives as a donation or a gift. You know, I really enjoy exploring this precept of not stealing and my thoughts on the subject. So I think I'll end here for the sake of time. I appreciate the opportunity to share this with you. Thank you for listening. So we'll take just a minute of silence and then John will speak.
So good evening, everyone, and thank you for being here. As you know, we don't share each other's talks, so there's going to be some overlap, and that happens in all our talks. So you may see that in this talk. So as you're all familiar with by now, our everyday Zen tradition is always to emphasize the affirmative nature of the precept. The second grave precept is I vow to receive gifts, not to steal. And much of what I'll speak on is on the receiving side and the giving side. So in this precept, we are asked not just not to steal or take from others, but to receive the numerous incalculable gifts we are given, beginning with the most meaningful and beautiful gift of all, our life itself. Life is an overwhelming gift. We often fail to grasp the enormity and rarity that we exist at all. It is a miracle just to be alive. Only 30% of the entire universe is matter. 70% is invisible dark matter that we have yet to understand. The fraction of living matter in the universe is something like 1/1,000,000,000%, and that's not even speaking of intelligent life, just living matter. That we exist as human beings, capable of self-awareness and comprehension of the universe we live in and from which we came, is nothing short of an incredible blessing. One version of this precept is, everything belongs to us and nothing belongs to us. We don't take anything unless it is given as a gift. Another version is, being satisfied with what I have, I will not take anything not given. Practicing contentment by freely giving. This is far, far broader than not stealing. Here, in receiving and gratitude for life's gifts, we are asked to live a life of contentment rather than grasping or desiring from others or the world around us, which only separates us from the whole. Life is short and precious. In this Sangha, we truly are more likely to understand how we really don't own anything. The lure of acquisitions is largely behind us as we pare down. Less is more. What are we going to do with all this stuff as we continue our transition from these aging bodies? Yet how fortunate we are to have what we have when so many have so little. I have stuff in storage I haven't seen in years, and I'm having difficulty paring down as I and my wife look for a more age-friendly house in which to live. Giving these things away, especially to those in need, is a freeing and fulfilling experience. I find that the not taking anything that is not given part of this precept much more meaningful than not to steal. I doubt anyone here would say they intentionally engage in stealing from anyone. But the precept here does not require intention. It's not intentional stealing. It includes the unrecognized acts of stealing or taking that we may constantly be doing in our lives, that we don't even see, but is evidenced in our actions, that this precept asks us to explore. Some are obvious. Like the environment. Am I nurturing the earth or harming it? Am I using more resources than I need? Am I even aware of my taking from the earth that sustains us all? I drive a gas-guzzling SUV, yet I need an SUV to haul and move things, and the cost and efficiency of a new electric model doesn't yet make sense. I try to rationalize my carbon footprint. Such as, I haven't flown anywhere in years. I'm not sure of the balance. I try to conserve. I certainly recycle. I care for the land. But is it enough? Recently, the county, which I licensed my septic system from, admonished me for not controlling the gophers, which they said eventually would harm the leach lines. Now I have two precepts to deal with. Killing gophers is bad enough. But how to do so without harming the environment in a way that doesn't harm the other creatures, like the hawks and bobcats and foxes and blue heron that often feed on them. Clearly, poison is not an option, and traps won't work in a large infestation. The most environmental and humane way turns out to be a machine the size of a large lawnmower that creates carbon monoxide to put them to sleep, so to speak, and leaves a completely non-toxic footprint. I feel terrible with this option, but it's the closest I can get to living these two precepts as best I can. What is most important here is that we each have to address for ourselves how to live on this earth without taking from or harming her. Some taking is less clear and more insidious, like the way we deal with others, especially if they have a very different point of view or belief than our own. When we stop listening to others and move to judgment, we belittle them. This too is taking because we diminish our view of their dignity, their humanity, their Buddha nature. We grasp to our self-judgment and close our ears and our hearts in a way that we are not able to move to the compassion and love in our hearts that is necessary to resolve any conflict. In Norman's Taking Our Places, he talks of an example of failing negotiations between a green priest group and a logging company doing just this. The opposing groups were stuck in stalemate by their inability to comprehend each other's point of view. For me, it's the current MAGA political movement. I naturally seem to go to condemnation and judgment in sincerely feeling the rightness of my beliefs. I stop talking to some family members about politics in an attempt to avoid the division from affecting my feelings for them. And it kind of does. I'm hiding behind a wall of righteous morality, the very thing that in my mind I accuse of them. I know this is wrong. And in a way, I am relieved the election wasn't close. I'm forced to look at myself and my own actions without projection, to acknowledge the holding back of myself, rather than sharing myself or opening to opposing viewpoints. I'm clearly not honoring our practice of humility, compassion, or generosity. Now, the positive side of this precept naturally is the receiving of life's gifts with gratitude and the practice of generosity. In Norman's Greenpeace example with the loggers, they employed a love strategy to develop generous feelings for the logging negotiators and created expansiveness in their feelings and views instead of the smallness and stinginess they had been experiencing. And it worked. With my own family, I'm trying hard to practice humility and listening without judgment, and to take refuge in our core teaching of not knowing, to open my heart and be with them as intimately as I can, to acknowledge them as the family who I have always cared for and loved. They are, as this precept reminds me, irreplaceable gifts that I should honor and cherish. Fully giving ourselves to others and receiving their responses with the dignity we would consider of our own thoughts and actions is one of the most intimate gifts we can possibly give. I know this by our teachings, yet often lose my way in placing myself or my thoughts above others. And I know this gets in the way of developing the feeling of love and compassion I aspire to and have vowed to live. There are two Buddhist practices I know of that help me in the practice of this precept. One is the idea of receiving the gifts not given, and the other is the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift, that we chant every day in the meal chant. Receiving the gifts not given is really the practice of contentment and gratitude as a way of life, and these gifts reside everywhere. If we were to believe all the commercials and commercialism around us, you would think the wealthiest of us would be the most happy people in the world, or conversely, the poorest, the least happy. But clearly that isn't so. I know of quite a few really miserable, successful people who, despite their wealth, mistreat others and have incredibly broken families. They can even be miserable of their own wealth for it not being enough, always seeking more as if an addiction of sorts. And I have known very poor people with hearts of gold that even in their poverty are always giving of themselves with an open heart and seemingly content with their relationships and their faith. I think we all know examples of both these in our lives. Receiving the gifts not given is not materialism, obviously. It's the opposite. We all know the most important gifts in life are far from material. Contentment is not about wealth. It's about giving and receiving love and compassion. It's about intimacy. Each of us is a gift to the other. Every human being is Buddha nature. Everything is Buddha nature. The air is a gift. The sea is a gift. The mountains and rivers and trees and clouds, the birds, the animals, the stars, all of it are gifts if we are willing to receive it. In this light, it is easier to understand our own meal chant. May we, with all beings, realize the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. Norman, in an article written for Lion's Roar in 2020, said, "A Zen practitioner about to eat a meal remembers that giving is life, that everything is giving, everything is given. There are no separate givers, receivers, or gifts. All of life is always giving and receiving at the same time. This is our practice and our joy. So we practice giving, both receiving and giving gifts in this spirit." So there's a sacred power of sorts in this giving a gift, receiving a gift, and the gift itself. It can be a source of joy on opening our hearts, as Norman says. How do we receive love and gifts from others around us? Is there a feeling of not deserving or lack of self-esteem? Hearts that have been hurt badly easily harden as a way of self-protection and cause us to have difficulty with receiving. Real intimacy involves receiving, to be open, to be vulnerable, even when it can feel uncomfortable or risky. Dogen wrote on receiving in the classical Bandawa, "We open our hand and it is filled," in a way that says it all on how to receive. We open our hand and it is filled. I love these words. And Dogen again, in the Bodhisattva's Four Methods of Guidance, he says of giving, "You give yourself to yourself and others to others. Know that to give to yourself is part of giving. To give to your family is also giving. Even when you give a particle of dust, you should rejoice in your own act, because you authentically transmit the merit of all Buddhas and begin to practice an act of a bodhisattva. To launch a boat or build a bridge is an act of giving. If you study giving closely, you see that to accept a body and to give up the body are both giving. Making a living and producing things can be nothing other than giving. To leave flowers to the wind, to leave birds to the seasons are also acts of giving." I find these words are some of Dogen's most beautiful teachings, especially about the part to accept a body and to give up the body are both giving. So everything we do really is an act of giver, receiver, and gift, not just the material things. Listening, loving, sharing ourselves, our work, our creations, our very practice together, all gifts given and received. We are not taking, we are certainly not coveting or stealing. We are simply living our bodhisattva practice. As Norman says, giving to others does not diminish us, it expands us. our hearts and minds open more widely, and generosity can be expanded without limit. There is no limit to how much you can give inside. So here I see an opening, a Dharma gate of sorts, to true gratitude. True gratitude really is the fullest expression of understanding this precept. What I already have is more than I could ever hope for or dream of. For me, that I am alive, that I am well, that I am not in need, that I am loved, that I have the Dharma, that I have the Sangha. And for those that are in need, or sickly, or homeless, or at war, or experience many of the other horrors of the world, where their taking is quite a different matter, very different matter. What of those that receive the taking of their very dignity and often their life? I know that in our total interconnectedness with all things, that I am them as well, and that truly feeling their pain and suffering and giving our compassion and love to them is also our bodhisattva practice. I may not understand the how or the why, but this offering is all I have in the faith of my not knowing practice. Although we are responsible for the ethical conduct of the life we are living, nothing is absolute or simple when it comes to ethics. And my sense is we just have to do the best we can with the life we are given in this present moment we find ourselves, and have faith in our continual practice as giver, receiver, and gift. So thank you for listening, and thank you for your practice. And now we'll just take a moment of silence before we go into the breakout rooms.
So we're going to go into small groups. There'll be three in each group. You have 4 minutes each to speak, and then there'll be a 3-minute wrap up after that. And we have two questions for you to consider. The first one, where do you find resistance in yourself to receiving life's gifts? Where do you find resistance in yourself to receiving life's gifts? The second, talk about an interaction or situation where you felt something had been taken away from you, and how did that make you feel?